Good afternoon. Please be seated, or if you're at the podium, I guess perhaps you want to stand there since you're probably next up. For the record today, we are back out of recess, the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's March 21st, 2019. We are ready for the fifth matter on our oral argument calendar. Today, I'll ask the clerk to call the matter, and then I'm going to check in with counsel just to make sure that we have everyone here. Actually, let me check in first. So I can see the Douglas County Attorney right in front of me. Is that Mr. Larson?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And then do we also have an appellant's attorney?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Arthur Walden.
All right.
Appearing on behalf of appellant.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Walden. And what I'm doing is our television is voice activated. You probably know that. So we get to see you when you're talking. So now I'll make sure that we have the matter called on the calendar for our recording. So, Mr. Marshall, when you're ready.
State of Minnesota respondent, Joseph Gordon Jerome Walker, appellant. Case number
18-1293. All right, and counsel, I can see that you're both here and ready to proceed. Of course, the appellant gets the first turn, and I'll just remind you, counsel, to again state your name for the record and who you represent. We look forward to our conversation with you today. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, good afternoon. My name is Arthur Walden, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Joseph Walker. The emergency aid exception to the warrant requirement is not an exception that should be applied broadly. And in fact, this court in State versus McLean noted that facts giving rise to the emergency aid exception occur in rare cases. This is not one of those rare cases. Now, where the facts are not in dispute, this court independently reviews the facts to determine whether, as a matter of law, the district court erred in denying a motion to suppress evidence. Because the district court erred in denying Mr. Walker's motion to suppress evidence based upon the illegal search of his residence, we respectfully request this court reverse the district court. Now, the emergency aid exception applies essentially in two scenarios. The first, when law enforcement is needed to render aid to somebody who is injured, or a second scenario where law enforcement is needed to protect an individual from imminent injury or imminent danger. The record and the facts in this case demonstrate that Ms. Anderson suffered no injury and there was no need to render emergency aid. The facts show that at that bar, at the fire station bar, Mr. Walker had a scoop shovel, swung the shovel maybe at or near Ms. Anderson, and he ended up striking a vehicle. There were numerous patrons outside, had followed them outside, and some observed this activity. Nobody indicated that they saw Ms. Anderson being actually struck or physically hit or suffering any type of injury. Well, nobody called.
Didn't one of the bar patrons, and this is on the in-squad video, tell the deputy that the male swung a shovel at the female ducked in the swing or a subsequent swing struck the vehicle?
Yes, struck the vehicle. But there was
but
no.
Only because she ducked, it sounds like, from this statement.
From that statement, yes. And
that,
there's no.
That was the information the officers had.
At that point, correct. They subsequently learned that there was no. There were no other individuals that indicated that Ms. Anderson was struck, and even that individual on the dispatch recording did not indicate that Ms. Anderson had been hit with that shovel or with any other instrument. When law enforcement responded, they saw the shovel, which Mr. Walker left at the bar before he headed east. The officers investigated. They observed that shovel. They saw no indication of blood or hair or anything that may be present when an individual is struck with an object like that. There was no blood or anything in the immediate vicinity of that, which one would also presumably expect to see if somebody had been struck with a shovel. There was no request by Ms. Anderson to anybody regarding a need for help, no request to call an ambulance or anybody to come and tend to her. She was later seen walking away from the bar alone, and nobody observed any type of indicia she had suffered any injury. She wasn't stumbling, she wasn't falling down, she wasn't looking back and calling for help, you know, asking for any type of assistance with an injury. The facts and the record show that at that bar, before she left, there was no injury that she sustained. Now, she later went towards a home, went towards the 110 Sandstead Street residence. And officers indicated that they were concerned for her welfare based upon various factors that they deemed noteworthy at the bar. When they got to the residence, there again was no indicia of any injuries that Miss Anderson suffered. There was no blood on the sidewalk leading up to the house. There was nothing on the front stairs. There was nothing on the front door, that being blood or any other indication that there was an injury. There were no cries for the need to render medical aid. And, you know, this was not a situation where she suffered any injury. It was based upon the fact that Mr. Walker swung the shovel at or near her, struck the vehicle. The officers believe that there may be a potentially dangerous situation.
Is there any evidence in the record to suggest that the officers were not primarily, their intent wasn't primarily to make sure that she was okay, but rather that their intent was motivated by a desire to arrest appellant, your client, or seize evidence?
Well, Your Honor, if they had wanted to arrest Mr. Walker, they could have walked into that home and presumably arrested him if they had probable cause to believe that a domestic assault had occurred, as the state outlined in its brief. The fact that Deputy Ziegler conceded that when he arrived at that location, he had no information that indicated an immediate threat to Miss Anderson's safety or an immediate need for medical aid, that did not provide an objectively reasonable emergency. And if there's no objectively reasonable emergency, we don't even get to the subjective beliefs of the officers and the motivation to search. The claim that there's also an imminent threat to Ms. Anderson as a basis to search that residence is also misplaced. And backing up to the injury portion, in State versus Lemieux, where the Minnesota Supreme Court found that the exception did apply, there was physical evidence. There was a brutal murder in the area, and a residence in very close proximity. The window of that residence was open. There was a torn screen, and there was music skipping. There was no response by any occupants inside to the officers' requests. And there was actually blood on the exterior wall of the home under that window, which there shows a clear indication that there may be an immediate need for medical aid, or that somebody may be in imminent danger. We don't have that here. There's no physical evidence either at the bar, on the way home, or at the residence that there was any type of injury. And the facts of this case are more akin to the facts of State versus McLean, where this court held that the emergency exception didn't apply because there was no objectively reasonable emergency there. their law enforcement was investigating a stabbing, and they knew that the victim was associated with a certain address. They went to that address. They observed blood on the sidewalk leading up to that residence. But getting to the residence and approaching, there was no blood on the front steps. There was no blood on the foyer. There was no blood on the exterior of the front door. And based upon that lack of physical evidence, even with blood being on the sidewalk leading up to it, that was still not enough to rise to the level of, you know, the emergency aid exception applying. Here, we don't have that physical evidence. We don't even have the blood on the sidewalk that they had in McLean. And, you know, this is not one of those rare cases where the emergency aid exception applies. The district court noted throughout its order denying the motion to suppress, you know, the potentially dangerous situation that could be present, and the officer's belief that they needed to check on the welfare of Miss Anderson, the belief that there may be a potential threat of danger, but the potential threat of danger, the potentially dangerous situation, does not rise to somebody being in imminent danger of injury. There's a clear requirement that it be an immediate need, not a potential for something to occur in the future.
So, counsel, you've emphasized the absence of blood, and that, at least in the case law, the other couple examples that you cited, blood has been present. But I don't think you mean to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that blood would be necessary. And I guess to bring you back to the facts of this case, you know, we have the officer approaching the door and knocking first. I think I follow this, but you let me know if I have it wrong, and has a quick view of a woman who closes curtains. Now, if that quick view had shown to the officer that the woman had bruises on her face, would that have been enough to then go to the second window and check in?
I think that would have definitely provided more of a basis than we have here. Yes, and I'm not arguing that there need to be blood present in every case, but at least some objective evidence that there was an injury sustained or that there was an imminent threat of danger.
But then the next confusing part I have with that position is that the domestic assault statute doesn't require physical injury to have probable cause for a violation of the domestic assault statute, right?
Correct.
Okay. So help me out and understand why evidence of actual injury is required.
Well, and backing up to the domestic assault statute that's noted in the state in respondents' brief in the footnote, if there had been probable cause that a domestic assault occurred, Deputy Ziegler, pursuant to the statute, would have been more than authorized to enter that residence to arrest Mr. Walker. He didn't do that, which just goes to show that there was no objective basis for any subsequent search of the window. You know, in McLean, the court noted that the fact that the two officers were at that residence investigating and they waited for another officer to show up is a conflict in any argument that there's an immediate need for medical assistance or an immediate threat of harm. That's exactly what we had here. Deputy Ziegler and Sergeant Peterson showed up to that residence on Sandstead Street. They approached the front door. They knocked. They didn't get a response that they could come in. They had observed the female close the curtains, and they waited for another officer to show up. You know, had an individual been in immediate need of medical assistance, waiting for another officer to show up just completely cuts against that, as well as, you know, any claim that Miss Anderson was in imminent danger. You know, Deputy Ziegler conceded the fact that when he showed up, there was no information that he had that she was in any immediate threat. And if she had been injured or if there was a threat, when she opened that curtain or closed the curtain rather at the front of the house, could have easily signaled for law enforcement to help. And I know that the deputy testified that not all victims of domestic violence or domestic assault cooperate with law enforcement. But this is a situation where there was an incident that occurred at a bar. Ms. Anderson left that bar voluntarily alone, followed Mr. Walker to the home. You know, the claim that not all victims cooperate with law enforcement would have much more traction had the two left together in the vehicle, or had Mr. Walker, you know, grabbed her by the hand and pulled her away from the bar, walking back towards the house, or even if an incident had occurred initially in the home and had remained there. You know, I think those are situations where that argument might have a little greater weight. Because the record demonstrates that there was no injury sustained by Ms. Anderson, and when the officers arrived at that house, they still had no basis to believe that she was injured, and that the officer testified, Deputy Ziegler testified, that there was no immediate threat to her, the emergency aid exception does not apply in this case, and the district court erred in applying it when denying the motion to suppress. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
And respondent, you can proceed with your argument when you are ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Chad Larson. I'm the Douglas County attorney, the attorney for the respondent today. As a preliminary matter, I would just like to point out that the respondent's brief contains erroneous references to the defendant in the argument section. This language came from a brief in the co-defendant's case, and so I apologize for any confusion that may have resulted. Ladies and gentlemen, the appellant essentially argues that because law enforcement didn't break into his home, there must not have been an emergency. As the district court correctly pointed out, that's not the test. The issue is whether the three-pronged test set forth in Lemieux apply to these facts. And so I'd like to briefly go through those prongs as they apply to the facts in this case. First of all,
about the facts. So my reading is that on May 1st at about 12:26 a.m., the police respond to the call of a fight in progress at a bar. They get to the bar at 12:26, is that right? I'm trying to get the timeline down. So
my understanding is that the call came in at 12:26 and they proceeded to drive to Garfield, which is a small town outside of Alexandria. I'm not exactly certain of the time that they arrived at the bar.
Is it under normal circumstances, maybe this isn't in the record, how long does it take to get to Garfield? And if it's not in the record, then I don't need to know.
I don't believe that's in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, so they get there, and then they're told that about the fight that had happened, but that the man and woman had walked away to an apartment about a block away. Is that right?
That's correct.
And did they walk together?
The record indicates that she walked behind him to the residence.
And do we know what time the officers got to the residence?
Deputy Ziegler testified that from the time they arrived at the bar initially to the time that they went and knocked on the door of the residence was approximately 10 to 15 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honors, in this case, the officers had reasonable grounds to believe that an emergency existed and there was an immediate need for law enforcement assistance. As the deputies arrived at the residence, here's what they knew. The appellant had been arguing and fighting with his girlfriend. He was intoxicated, drunk, high, or both. He had attempted to fight other patrons at the bar. He smashed the windshield of another bar patron's vehicle with a shovel. He swung the shovel either at his girlfriend or in her direction. We have a witness that says he swung at her and she ducked. It is unknown to these deputies at that time whether she was injured or not. Officers knew the identities of both parties. It was very late at night.
What was the, just
and they knew
now,
that.
Hold on, I have a question. What is the evidence
yes.
that she was injured?
I don't believe we have evidence that she was injured.
There
the officers didn't know.
It seems that there was no evidence that she was actually hit by the shovel.
Correct. There wasn't evidence one way or the other. They didn't know whether she was or wasn't hit. They both knew the identities of both parties, and the deputies knew that they were both inside of this residence. So these weren't vague tips that someone might be in danger. Anyone who would swing a shovel at someone with such force as to smash a windshield is clearly a threat, and anyone who is the target of that threat is in imminent danger. So Deputy Ziegler proceeded to the residence one block away, knocked on the door. A female immediately appeared in the window and shut the curtains. The deputy at that time did not know whether that female was in fact the appellant's girlfriend or not. No one answered the door. So at this point, appellant argues that the officers should have just packed up and left. They didn't see any blood. Nobody was screaming inside, and nobody answered the door. And I would suggest that this would not be a reasonable response from a law enforcement to a domestic assault or a domestic altercation call.
So how do you respond to appellant's argument that when the woman did open and immediately close the curtains, that she didn't call out to Ziegler, didn't make any effort to seek his help or officer's help?
Well, the deputy at that time didn't know how many people were in the residence, and he had no reason or no ability to ascertain whether she, in fact, was the person who had the shovel swung at her. Law enforcement officers under these circumstances have an obligation to ascertain whether appellant's girlfriend was safe or not, whether she was injured, whether an assault was continuing to occur. They would have been derelict in their duties had they not done that. And as Deputy Ziegler testified and appellant pointed out, domestic assault victims don't always cooperate with law enforcement. And again, there's witnesses that told the responding officers that both of these individuals appeared to be tweaking and impaired. So the deputy went around to the side of the house and looked in the window. He observed that who appeared to be appellant's girlfriend was not injured, and at that point, the emergency in his mind had dissipated. But it was only until that point. He also observed the contraband at that point in time that the appellant seeks to suppress. Officers at that point prudently called one of the assistant county attorneys in my office, explained the facts, and was directed to obtain a search warrant. With respect to the second prong, this search was not primarily motivated by intent to arrest or to seize evidence. There is absolutely no reason for Deputy Ziegler to expect to see drugs in this house when he looked in the window. His sole motivation for looking in the window was to ensure Miss Anderson's safety. As to the third prong, there was a reasonable basis to associate the emergency with the place to be searched. And also, we're talking about a search that is very limited in scope to merely looking into a window. The district court concluded that the officers had a reasonable basis, approximating probable cause, to associate the emergency with the appellant's house. The appellant and his girlfriend were last seen outside that residence, which was located one block from the bar. And Deputy Ziegler knew that the appellant's vehicle was associated with that residence based on in-house sheriff records. I would also suggest that any application of the exclusionary rule under these facts would serve no purpose. It's unclear what misconduct the court would be trying to deter law enforcement from. They had the best interests of Ms. Anderson in mind. They were not motivated out of any animus towards the appellant or trying to search for drugs in his house. With that, I have nothing more to say unless the panel has questions of me.
I do have a couple of questions. At one point, I'm looking at page 12 of the district court's order. It seems like the district court may have drifted a bit from the Lemieux standard in a couple of places, saying the officer reasonably felt there was an ongoing concern for the welfare of Ms. Anderson. That sounds like a substantially lower burden than the Lemieux standard, which is in need of immediate aid or to protect an occupant from imminent injury. I'm looking at the last full paragraph on page 812. The officer felt there was an ongoing concern for the welfare of.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like an awfully low burden.
Right, and I think that's probably a lower burden than what Lemieux sets forth, but I think that under these facts, the Lemieux prongs are satisfied.
Well, but I'm not sure that, from that language, I'm not sure if the district court was applying the right standard, so that might make it a little harder for us to affirm the determination, which is based on a lowered standard. Does my question make sense?
I think so.
If the district court is just looking at it and saying, well, the officer had an ongoing concern about the welfare, so therefore he can enter the curtilage and start looking through windows, I don't think Lemieux would allow that based on merely on an ongoing concern.
And I understand it, but I think if the court looks at the totality of this opinion, I believe that the court did correctly apply the Lemieux standard. I know that it was outlined earlier in the court's analysis.
Yes, it's stated. That's, I guess, another way of asking my question. The district court seems to have stated the Lemieux standard, but then when the district court got down to applying that standard to the facts, it seems like he used a different standard.
Your Honor, I guess it's not my reading of the order.
Fair enough. That's all I got.
I'm sorry. I was not paying attention. So, counsel, for respondent, did you want to sum up in any way, or have you concluded your remarks, because we've concluded our questions?
I don't think I have anything else to add. I appreciate it. Thank you.
No, thank you, counsel. All right, and appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I will start with the last point that the court was inquiring about, and that being whether the district court essentially drifted away from the Lemieux standard, which, in our opinion, absolutely happened. This is a case about the emergency aid exception, not a concern exception, not a welfare check exception. We're not claiming that the officer should have merely packed up and left at that point, but proceeding to the side of the house, approaching the curtilage and looking through a window and conducting a search is, you know, an extreme step. There's a middle ground. The district court makes numerous references, and again on page 12, the district court states, prior to looking in the window, Deputy Ziegler reasonably believed there was an immediate need to check on the welfare of Ms. Anderson based upon events at the bar. Checking on Ms. Anderson's welfare is one thing. The need to render immediate medical aid is another thing, and a substantial increase in, you know, the need to enter or search a home. On the same line, the immediate need to check on Ms. Anderson's welfare falls far short of somebody being in imminent danger of injury. The district court also, in drifting, as we'll call it, repeatedly makes reference to the fact that the officers at the residence were concerned for officer safety and that somehow that justified their actions. Officer safety plays no part and is irrelevant to determine whether there's an emergency that exists regarding an occupant of that residence. The fact that the individuals, when the officers approached the house and knocked on the door and one female closed the curtains, the claim that there was an elevated concern because now these individuals are concealing their actions and this fear for officer safety is irrelevant in the analysis of whether an emergency existed that was objectively reasonable and justified application of the emergency aid exception. The argument that the district court also noted that the search was legal and justified because it was limited in scope. Whether it was limited in scope is also irrelevant. The search shouldn't have taken place, period. And the claim that anyone who would swing a shovel is a threat may be true while that individual is still at the bar, still has that shovel at the bar, and is still in the same state of mind and the same set of circumstances that are going on there. But Mr. Walker left that bar alone. He left the shovel at the bar. The officers had no information, no indication that he possessed any type of firearm or weapon at the residence, or that he had on any other occasions been engaged in any type of assaultive behavior. When Mr. Walker left alone and when Miss Anderson left alone, any type of imminent threat dissipated. It may not have completely vanished, but it dissipated to the point where there was no longer an imminent threat. And again, the potential for a dangerous situation or the potential that there's a threat of danger, again, is far, far short of an imminent threat of danger or an imminent threat of injury. Also, the claim that anyone who is a target of somebody swinging a shovel at them is in imminent danger. Again, if it's at that bar, that's one thing. But when that situation occurs and circumstances change, and that individual who was the target at that time, and we don't even know if she was the target or if Mr. Walker was just swinging the shovel and happened to be swinging at the car, but in her direction. But when they both leave that bar alone and end up at the same residence, it's an entirely different set of circumstances that doesn't rise to an imminent threat. And that is all I have, Your Honors. And again, we just ask that the district court's denial of Mr. Walker's suppression motion be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel for the arguments today. Much appreciated by the court. And this matter is now submitted to us for our decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. So with that, we have concluded the five oral matters on our oral calendar today, and we are in recess.
Thank you.